My name is Paul Olson, and the title of this session is The Holocaust, How Do We Know the Truth? What I'd like to do tonight is watch the video for 10 minutes, it's actually 11 minutes and 50 seconds, and then open it to give this invitation. The rest of the video, if you would like to watch it sometime, it goes on for another 45 minutes about it's the liberation films of the concentration camps right after the war. And then there are two other ones after that that are in color, and one of them is it's called The Courage to Dare, and it's about what I think we would call righteous Gentiles, people who risked their lives to save Jews. And the second one is called Reunion, and it's about an American pilot who was one of the guys that liberated the Jews at a particular concentration camp, and he meets one of the women that was in the camp that he liberated. And they've been living in the same community for years, and they get together, and they've both been silent for almost 30 or 20 or so years. Anyway, that's not tonight, but if you would ever like to see that, just let me know. I guard this video very closely, but I would let it out with a $300 deposit. So we'll run that video, and then we'll get into what I think might be a different kind of perspective of the Holocaust.
Moment to look back and to remember the awful legacy of Nazi Germany. There is a story behind tonight's film. It was made 30 years ago, but was only recently discovered in the archives of the Imperial War Museum in London. The film is a record of what the Allied forces found.
That's the video.
The Nazi death camps. For reasons that are not completely clear, the film was never finished. The version found in the archives is mostly silent. Soundtracks are missing. And the final reel was found only after our film was put together. However, a script to accompany the pictures was found. So we asked British actor Trevor Howard to read it. We decided to run the film uncut, unedited, as close as possible to what the producers intended 40 years ago. They made it as a document to serve our collective memory. And I must warn you, it is harrowing and painful to watch. But 11 million people died in those death camps. 6 million were Jews. We should never forget.
The German people had embarked on that long, incredible journey that led seemingly out of chaos to unprecedented triumph. After promise had been fulfilled. Austria 1938, Czechoslovakia 1938, Poland 1939, Norway, Denmark, and France in quick succession. A place in the sun at last. Trade unions and a lot of books to be burned, but it seemed a good sort of bargain. One got to like being told what to do. Having one's views prescribed, especially if it meant a vista bright with the promise of grandeur and conquest. Spring of 1945, the Allies, advancing into the heart of Germany, came to Bergen-Belsen. Neat and tidy orchards, well-stocked farms lined the wayside, and the British soldier did not fail to admire the place and its inhabitants, at least until he began to feel a smell. It came from a concentration camp, a waste ringed with barbed wire and overlooked by watchtowers. coming in from the flowering countryside, in spite of the frightful smell, things didn't seem so bad at first. Children smiled through the barbed wire, and women laughed and waved their hands. But Belsen Camp was vast, and inside was a different story. They had not eaten for 6 days, and every soldier's stock of food was called into use. Water, too, had been cut off, and so the water cart was the most important thing to arrive. Most of the people seemed to be listless beyond hope and astonishment. Hunger had probably affected them that way. We discovered that among this stench of disease and decay was something a bit worse than hunger. Moving vaguely on rickety skeleton legs, they were too ill to eat. How grateful they were for a kindly word or gesture. What misery to live amongst such unmentionable filth, with scarcely the strength to pick the lice which inevitably swarmed over them. They seemed accustomed to the spell and the horror. They had seen all there was to see. Huts were almost impossible to go near. They were full of tangled masses of people who had died slowly and painfully of starvation and disease, writhing in agony, helpless in puddles of excrement. It was difficult to imagine those orchards now, those rich fields where the stolid cattle cropped the juicy grass. For here, a few minutes away, inside the barbed wire, was nothing but filth and death. Dead prisoners hurled out and stacked in twisted heaps. Dead women like marble statues in the mire. This was what these inmates had to live among and die among. The dead which lay there were not numbered in hundreds, but in thousands. Not 1 or 2 thousand, but 30,000. Here is a pit where the inmates, in order to earn food, had to drag the bodies of their comrades, but they were too weak to keep up with the rate at which they were dying. So the pit remains only half filled. The SS guards in charge of the camp were captured and lined up for examination. Their papers were gone through to confirm their status, their authority, each with his death's head badge, each justified by German law. They were unashamed, well-fed, well-dressed and cheerful. There were women also on guard in Belsen, volunteers who came of their own free will to do their bit. Not sickly pale with hollow faces and hungry eyes, but well-fed and well-kept with a strutting arrogance. The commandant of the camp, Josef Kramer, was removed for trial as a war criminal by an Allied military court. There was an urgent need to get rid of as many bodies as possible, as quickly as possible, so all the SS were set to work. 500 Hungarian troops captured with the SS were started on a grave digging operation. The SS themselves were made to do the unpleasant job they had forced the inmates to do. This, after all, was nothing to these men. They, the master race, had been taught to be hard. They could kill in cold blood, and it seemed to the British soldier fit and proper that the killers should bury the nameless, hopeless creatures they had starved to death. The faces of the bystanders showed just a little of the hate that Germany has inspired, and some of the anguish, too.
Don't show me any more pictures. I don't want to know about children in cattle cars, about women being taken away, about men in horse carts, about mass goodbyes and unearthly cries. Throw away those pictures, I said. I don't want to know. Let me pretend that my people were kings in freedom, that the children were princes on horseback, that the women were queens of it all. Throw away those pictures, I said. I don't want to know. No, my parents were not murdered. No, my grandparents were not slaves. No, my arm has no number. It happened once to another tribe. It happened once in another age. Put away those pictures. Don't show them around my house. How can I tell my children we were treated worse than rubbish? The garbage men here wear gloves. And pictures were taken of it all? Don't show me anymore. Don't tell me anymore. Don't. I didn't know how else to introduce an experience of the Holocaust. I'm not unaware of the pitfalls that await somebody who was non-Jewish, that await somebody who is, of course, not a survivor, not an inhabitant. Kathy Brown calls them non-inhabitants of the concentration camps. And in fact, historically, in literature, there's been a big debate about whether or not anybody can touch the issue because it's so painful and so personal. Can anybody who's not a survivor, who or at least who isn't Jewish, touch the topic of the Holocaust? Robert McCaffey Brown says this: the experience they endured is not an experience the rest of us can share. Well, I expected that would be true of everybody in this room, that this is not an experience that we can share. McCaffey Brown, in a book, by the way, that's in the library, also says, if Jewish survivors of the camps cannot communicate their experience, how can non-Jews who were never in the camps, even approach the subject? What possible credentials could authenticate our right to do so? He goes on, we live in a different universe. Ours is a universe in which Auschwitz has never entered. Theirs is a universe from which it is never absent. Elie Wiesel also raises the argument. What right do we here at Holden Village, and I think there are no less than 3 tapes on the Holocaust, what right do we have to broach the subject? How can we even try? Wiesel raises the question too. Accept the idea that you will never see what they have seen, and go on seeing now, that you will never know the faces that haunt their nights, that you will never hear the cries that rent their sleep. Accept the idea that you will never penetrate the cursed and spellbound universe they carry within themselves with unfailing loyalty. And so I tell you, you who have not experienced their anguish, you who do not speak their language, you who do not mourn their dead, think before you offend them, before you betray them. Think before you substitute your memory for theirs. So, class dismissed, I guess. But obviously, I don't feel that way, and I've taken some cues from McAfee Brown, and I've taken some cues from what I think, personally, is maybe the most important American novel written in the 20th century, Sophie's Choice by William Styron. I'm not going to defend that opinion, but I'm going to look at Sophie's Choice with you and look at Elie Wiesel with you briefly to suggest how non-Jews and non-survivors can look at the Holocaust. Part of my background for this is, first of all, I'll say I'm not an expert on the Holocaust. My academic background is in African-American literature, and that has expanded somewhat into what I call literature of the oppressed, and that has involved some literature of the Holocaust. But I'm not an expert. But my connectedness is the same as yours is. And I have to tell a very short story about my father many, many years ago when he was a high school principal in a small town in northern Minnesota. A very small town where the principal is the principal, the registrar, teaches a couple classes in German, and he's the truant officer. And our school was next to an Indian reservation, and we had the kids that went to school on the reservation for the first 6 years, and then they came to the high school. And 3 kids decided to skip school, 3 Indian kids decided to skip school one day. And my dad, as a determined truant officer, went after them. And it's a little town, he's driving his car alongside, and he catches up to these guys, and they run out into the lake, up to here, and say, come and get us. He got out of the car, walked out in the lake right after him, grabbed him by the collar and brought him back to school, set him down in their chairs and said, you're going to go to school. He told me later, I was just a little kid, that some of his colleagues had kind of joked with him, what the heck do you do that for? Who cares? You know they're just going to go out and turn to be alcoholics on the reservation anyway. None of them are going to stay in school. Why bother? And my dad told me then, what he told them, I am not going to let those kids think that their life is negligible. And I'm not going to let those kids think that their life is meaningless and that they don't matter. And if the social situation exists that leads to the prediction that the rest of the faculty had or his colleagues had for him, so be it. But he wasn't going to let it happen. And one story. The other story is not a story, it's just a short line. This didn't happen to us, but it happened to our sisters. And it happened to our brothers. And because it did, my own personal approach to African-American literature as a white Norwegian is it happened to my sisters and it happened to my brothers. And we not only have a right to step into that ground, we probably have an obligation not to be silent about an injustice that we know about. Not to be silent when we know that, as a student of mine in the seminary, in 1984 told me, the years may doesn't matter, but in 1984, this student in the seminary, who was a German pastor from Germany, told me that Today, in 1984, there are 150 books published in Germany that deny that the Holocaust existed. We know about that kind of revisionist stuff that's going on in America and all over the world today, too. Thus, it happened to our brothers and it happened to our sisters, and we have an obligation, perhaps, not to be silent. How do we tell, or how do we know what's true and what's not true? And how do we read, as a friend of mine, or a new friend here at Holden, as we stood in line for the banquet last Saturday night, said, I told him about the 150 books, and he said, well, what if you're one of those people that's all you've read, is those 150 books? And I ran down here to the registrar, or to the staff coordinator, and changed my topic for tonight. It was going to be African-American poetry. And I said, if I have a chance to teach something about the Holocaust, I'm going to do it. Because what if we are those people who read just that 150 books? Thus, we step into our obligation again. Not just me, but all of us. Well, Robert McCaffey Brown also suggests how we, you know, decide what's true. Are these 150 books, or does Elie Wiesel's Night, as some of these revisionists would say, that's an exaggeration. It's not true. Didn't happen. Those really weren't gas chambers. And really, maybe only, get that, that's the word they use, only a million died. I might throw out to you that there are some estimates now that the Soviet Union has opened up that there might be 28 million. I know I've read that figure. So we don't know yet what's happened. But how do we know what to believe? Robert McCaffey Brown suggests something that I think is pretty interesting, especially as an English teacher who likes stories. If we are to learn from the Holocaust survivors, we must listen to stories. Elie Wiesel's stories, they challenge our stories. They open horizons we had never seen before. They smash barriers we had thought were impregnable. They leave us desolate. They also bind us in new and deeper relationships. Well, to talk like an English teacher for a second, that is exactly what literature is supposed to do. Bind us in new relationships. It's impossible to be involved in literature without sensing your own belonging to a community that is far broader than any we ever anticipated or ever participated in before. We belong to the community. And then back to my father telling me about the Indians, back to my own sense of this, it happened to my brother. It happened to my sister. I have an obligation. William Styron, in Sophie's Choice, now Styron is not Jewish, and Sophie's Choice is a book, despite what you might hear from some literary, not literary critics, but from some critics who don't like, there's a lot of sex in it, there's a lot of violence in it, and there's a lot of alcohol and drugs in it. But it's a story about a survivor of Auschwitz. And if you go on to read Sophie's Choice, I encourage you to do that. Just, I'll point out to you ahead of time that those scenes of alcohol and drugs and sex are Sophie's attempt to replace her life with a God that she's lost because she has survived Auschwitz. And I'll look at that more in a second. But in this long novel that looks at Auschwitz and what it is to be a survivor of Auschwitz, Styron, too, suggests, I am not unaware that I'm walking on hallowed ground and that I don't have any right to. He quotes another writer. George Steiner remarks, it is not clear that those who are not themselves fully involved should touch upon these agonies unscathed. And Styron says, I have been haunted, I must confess, by an element of presumption in the sense of being an intruder upon the terrain of an experience so bestial, so inexplicable, so undetachably and rightfully the possession alone of those who suffered and died or survived it. A survivor, Elie Wiesel, has written, novelists made free use of the Holocaust in their work. In so doing, they cheapened it, drained it of its substance. The Holocaust was now a hot topic. End of his quote from Wiesel. It's fashionable, guaranteed to gain attention and to achieve instant success. And Styron says, I do not know how ultimately valid any of this is, but I am aware of the risk. As a teacher, I take my cue from Styron too. I don't know how valid this is, but I am aware of the risk. But then listen to him. And he's speaking to all of us, not just English teachers. Yet I cannot accept Steiner's suggestion that silence is the answer. And he quotes Steiner, that it is best not to add to the trivia of literary sociological debate to the unspeakable. Nor do I agree with the idea that, in the presence of certain realities, art is trivial or impertinent. And surely, and if I could have you memorize any phrase at all, and I tell students in class when I want them to do that, is to write it on their forehead backwards so every time they look in the mirror in the morning they'll see it. It would be this statement out of Sophie's Choice. And surely, almost cosmic in its incomprehensibility as it may appear, the embodiment of evil which Auschwitz has become remains impenetrable only so long as we shrink from trying to penetrate it, however inadequately. So, inadequately I may go now into this journey into the Holocaust and a look at it that might supply us with a perspective on our role in seeing it and our role in connecting with our sisters and brothers. And I'm going to borrow a phrase from one of my favorite, though I don't understand him, if anybody here does, sometime talk to me, poets from 19th century England, William Blake. And Blake suggests that all humans go on this journey, the journey from innocence to experience, and then maybe to what he calls higher innocence. He also argues that the only person in the world that actually did that, guess, Jesus. And Blake is a mystic Christian poet. And he says that most of us die here. Or maybe we struggle to get back to this, to this stage of naivety, and I don't want to know. And all of us, you know, many of us maybe, we've been parents, and my 18-year-old son comes home and says, "Where'd you go tonight?" And I don't want to know. Right? We all do that. We kind of want to stay here in this innocence. And what time did you get home last night? Never mind, I don't want to hear it. How many speeding tickets did you get? That one went through that one just last year. How many speeding tickets did you get this year? Never mind, I don't want to hear it. We struggle to somehow maintain this balance between innocence and experience because somehow it's so difficult to get past it. Well, another poet, a couple centuries earlier, that's also a favorite of mine, every poet, I got lots of favorites, John Milton, the guy who wrote Paradise Lost, would use a different word here, and I think it applies to our look, and I'm going to try to apply it at our look, or to our look at the Holocaust here. He applies the word virtue. And he says, in a phrase, virtue untested isn't really virtue. We have to go through this experience. We have to. Because if it's just, you know, we can keep our kids good if we just lock them in a room, right? But it's not really goodness. Well, Sophie's Choice is about that journey. And it's about that journey that a white Anglo-Saxon male takes on his journey from innocence and what he really decides in this innocent stage. What are his values? And does he really know, the other part of the title of this discussion, does he really know what evil is? Well, he doesn't. Sophie's Choice suggests to us, and I'm going to read some sections from it, that none of us does. What really is evil? And where do we draw the line with where we'll put our foot down and stop it at that? At the table I was at tonight for supper, we were joking about the speeding tickets that we had gotten. We had talked about our son getting one, and then I talked about the one time a cop stopped me and said, "You better slow down, there's a cop ahead." And nice cop, I like that guy. And we were joking about that, and probably all of us don't really pay much attention to 55 miles an hour, and that's a law. And we don't put our foot, well, we do put our foot down on that, don't we? Do this way, though. That's not a big deal to us. Then it gets a little tougher, and we sit in that classroom, and the guy next to us is cheating. Well, but I'm not cheating, so I'm not going to say anything. But I wouldn't cheat. But he does, and I don't like that, but I'm not going to tell him. Would we? I mean, most of us wouldn't do that. But we can keep going. I want to get to the literature. I want you to think about, at what point do we begin to stand up for something that we understand to be evil? Now, speeding, I don't know if it's evil or not. We won't get into that. And cheating, is it evil? I don't know. But surely we know that what comes out of this, what we just saw, that's evil. It's evil manifest in the most deliberate, institutionalized way imaginable by humankind. When do we put our foot down? Speeding, cheating, Holocaust. I'll tell you an interesting statistic that I learned from when I studied Sophie's Choice from books that Styron himself recommends that we read. 45,000 civilians were involved in the direct extermination of Jews. we heard on the video that these people came voluntarily to come to take care of the concentration camps. Well, in a book, Edric Frelick called Out of the Whirlwind, documents 45,000 civilians were involved in the direct extermination of Jews. Well, I'd like to consider the Holocaust, our look at it, as our journey out of innocence into experience, and maybe we'll get to higher innocence tonight, I don't know, but to some kind of understanding and a recognition of how do we put our finger on when evil has started. And we've already had a couple experiences. The video, we saw evil. The poem, we saw someone's response to this evil, someone who was personally affected. I don't want to see anymore. I don't want to believe this. And part of the innocent stage that's so eloquently spelled out in Elie Wiesel's Night, how many people have read this? I suspect that a lot of you would have. And I'm going to just read a couple passages in there to suggest that even as people are directly involved in the movement of the Holocaust, they're clinging to this innocent stage. Oh no, it can't be. And we'll look at some points here. The first sign that Wiesel talks about in Night is that the foreign Jews have been expelled from his little town, Cignet, in Hungary or Transylvania. Right after some of the foreign, after these foreign Jews get expelled, one of them is a rabbi, and he's gone for several weeks. And while he's gone, they have more signs. Someone says to him, "The Jews in Budapest are living in an atmosphere of fear and terror. There are anti-Semitic incidents every day in the streets, in the trains. The fascists are attacking Jewish shops and synagogues. The situation is getting very serious. The news spread like wildfire through Siget. Soon it was on everyone's lips, but not for long. Optimism soon revived. The Germans won't get as far as this. They'll stay in Budapest. There are strategic and political reasons." The attempt to stay in a world of innocence. No, this won't happen. Naivety is part of this. But it's more complicated than that, I think. It's naivety, but it's hope. It's innocence, but it's optimism. And it all gets tangled up, you know, I think in a complicated way that we can't just dismiss these people as simpletons who are naive. They hear, and we, just like the father who says, "No, I don't want to hear where you go, but I'm going to go off and imagine, you know, well, what was, you know, and imagine all kinds of things." So I mix together my own hope to stay naive about what my son does, but then my imagination takes off. Well, it does for these people too. I'm going to skip some stages, but more things happen. More signs happen. The next thing that happens at the Passover of 1944, all the Jewish leaders in his town are arrested. Next, the Jewish people, all of them, are not allowed to leave their houses for 3 days. Next, they have to hand over all objects of value, gold, diamonds, anything that is worth anything. Next, after these 3 days in which they're not allowed to leave their house, they have to come out and guess where the star, yeah. Then, they're not allowed in restaurants. Then, they create two ghettos in this little village of Siget. And finally, deportation. Deportation. "There are rumors going around," said my father in a broken voice, "that we're going somewhere in Hungary to work in the brick factories. Apparently, the reason is that the front is too close here." What do you make of it? Well, Moshe the Beadle, who was one of the foreign Jews that was sent out of the community, after 7 months of absence, he comes back. And he tells the people what's going on. And just anybody that's read it, I'm just going to ask you if you remember what the response is. The Beadle comes back and says, "They're burning the Jews. They're taking them off in railroad cars to," and he names some places, "to Auschwitz, to Birkenau, to Treblinka." He knows them. What do they tell him in his community? You remember?
He's crazy.
He's crazy. It's unthinkable. So part of the complicated stage here in the stage of innocence for all of us is, this is no way could this happen. This is so unthinkable that I can't even believe it. So in one sense, it's only natural to kind of stay here in this age of innocence, or the stage of innocence. This is impossible. No way could that happen in the 20th century. The question that little Ellie at 15 asks again and again and again to his father as they walk through the concentration camps that he's in. Dad, how does this happen in the 20th century? How can people be silent on the outside world? But they asked again and again. What does it come to? At the end of the book, Ellie's father is almost dead. I mean, Ellie knows he's going to die in a day or two. And someone comes up to him, puts his hand on his shoulder and says, "Listen to me, boy. Don't forget that you're in a concentration camp. Here, every man has to fight for himself and not think of anyone else, even of his father. Here, there are no fathers, no brothers, no friends. Everyone lives and dies for himself alone. I'll give you a sound piece of advice. Don't give your ration of bread and soup to your old father. There's nothing you can do for him, and you're killing yourself. Instead, you ought to be having his ration." It's come to this. And little 15-year-old Ellie has moved out of, this is what it's come to. I can't even save my father. And then those of you who have read it, and if you haven't, I suggest it's in the library here too. We learn of the young kid who runs away from his father. He's been trying to help him for months in the concentration camps. And on the long walk from Brno to Bergen-Belsen, or Birkenau, and he finally, his father's just too much of a burden, and he runs away. Sees his father fall and just takes off. It's come to this. And finally, at the end, the very end of the book, our first act as free men was to throw ourselves under the provisions. We thought only of that, not of revenge, not of our families, nothing but bread. And even when we were no longer hungry, there was still no one who thought of revenge. On the following day, some of the young men went to Weimar to get some potatoes and clothes and to sleep with girls, but of revenge, not a sign. 3 days after the liberation of Buchenwald, I became very ill with food poisoning. I was transferred to the hospital and spent 2 weeks between life and death. One day I was able to get up after gathering all my strength. I wanted to see myself in the mirror hanging on the opposite wall. I had not seen myself since the ghetto. From the depths of the mirror, a corpse gazed back at me. The look in his eyes as they stared into mine has never left me. There's, of course, much more to the book. But that's what McAfee calls the stories. And so maybe to get the truth, we have to go into those stories and not into those historical accounts that someone can revise and that shapes the perspective of someone who has, as the black slave suggested about American slavery, "'Tis not he who looked on who can describe slavery, but he who endured." So maybe McAfee has some truth to it. I mean, how do we understand what's true and what do we buy and believe? We have some sense of the stories, and the stories will tell us truth. 'Tis not he who looked on. And those revisionists, I suspect those 150 books published in 1984 in Germany are written by people who looked on, not those who endured. Well, this wonderful book, Sophie's Choice, takes people like us on this journey. And it begins to show us in the very beginning pages how evil creeps up so slowly out of this stage of innocence into experience. And in this novel, can that main character rise above his own experience? Stingo is the name of the narrator of the book, and the main character, well, Sophie and Stingo are the two main characters. But the story, really, it's about Sophie, but it's Stingo's journey, and I'll spell that out. Stingo is a young 22-year-old guy just out of the college and out of the army, and he's got a job at McGraw-Hill editing books and, you know, discarding and so on, accepting books for publication. And his boss comes up to him one day, his boss is appropriately named Weasel, and says, "I notice you don't wear a hat." "A hat?" I replied. "Why, no." "Well, everyone at McGraw-Hill wears a hat." "Everyone?" I replied. "Everyone," he said flatly. And of course, as I reflected on what he was saying, I realized that it was true. Everyone did wear a hat. In the morning, in the evening, and at lunchtime, the elevators and hallways were bobbing seas of straws and felts, all perched on the uniformly sheared, closely cropped scalps of McGraw-Hill's 1,000 regimented, it's a dark Xerox, what's the word? I can't read it. Anybody's got a hat on. This was at least true for men. For the women, mainly secretaries, it seemed to be optional. May I ask in what other way I haven't fitted the profile, says Stingo to his boss. Well, I cannot dictate your newspaper reading habits, nor do I want to, but it is not wise for a McGraw-Hill employee to be seen with a copy of the New York Post. That's a little kind of liberal magazine, or newspaper. It just does not look seemly for McGraw-Hill editors to be reading radical publications at the office. Well, what should I be reading then? The Herald Tribune might be more appropriate, he said. Well, Stingo then, in his flair for being his own man, starts to wear a felt army cap on top of his seersucker suit to work, and he starts blowing bubbles. Well, remember when you were little kids, those kind of plastic sticky bubbles you could blow? He brings that to work, and he blows those bubbles, and he starts reading, what's the communist magazine? Daily Worker, is that it? Yeah, he starts reading the Daily Worker. Well, Weasel comes up to him and says, pick up your check tonight, you're done, you're fired. Well, on his way out, he meets a colleague who's about 60 years old, whose son was the same age as Stingo when he was killed, the last soldier killed at Okinawa. And he says to Stingo, write your guts out, boy, because Stingo has told him he wants to be a novelist. He said, because my son wanted to write. He tells him the story about his son, and in the process, this man that he had been working with for a year and didn't know about his son starts to cry. And Stingo, the Styron then, ends this chapter having Stingo say this. It was true that I had traveled great distances for one so young, but my spirit had remained landlocked, unacquainted with love, and all but a stranger to death. So he's 22. And he lives in this world of innocence. And then we see a lot of silly sex scenes and silly fantasizing that Stingo has, because nothing in the world, he doesn't understand anything that's really important. And there's one whole page, and it bores you as a reader until you catch on what's going on. He just stands there and lists all the items that are in his medicine cabinet. And his biggest worries are where he's going to get his next shaving cream from because he's out of money, how he's going to pay his rent, and where he's going to find a girl who will have sex with him. Those are his worries. Until he meets Sophie, a survivor of Auschwitz. Sophie, who brings to him experiences that Stingo never dreamed were a part of the world. And brings to him an awareness of evil that began for us as readers to put this Weasel guy in a context of evil too. Weasel has parameters for life that are this way, and you can't step outside those. You got to wear this hat, you got to read this magazine, and you better not blow bubbles at work. He meets Sophie, and Sophie, how many people have seen the movie Sophie's Choice? Okay, the movie, it's wonderful, and Meryl Streep is the greatest, I think. The movie is about the psychological and emotional scars of being a survivor. The book is about, I would say, the theological scars of apostasy, of having lost your faith. And Sophie, early in the book, after Stingo has met her, says this to Stingo. So, Stingo, I've lived very long with this very, very strong guilt, which I can't lose, even though I know it has no reason. I have this strong guilt because, you know, I have learned to cry again. And I think perhaps that means I am a human being again, perhaps that at least. A piece of a human being, but yes, a human being. Often I cry alone when I listen to music, which reminds me of Krakow and those years past. And you know, there is one piece of music that I cannot listen to. It makes me cry so much my nose stops up. I cannot breathe. My eyes run like streams. It is these Handel records I got for Christmas. I know that my Redeemer liveth, that make me cry because of all my guilt. And also because, and I would imagine her voice rising, and also because I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God. The most profound experience that Stingo has encountered is this guy who's unacquainted with death and all but a stranger to love. He loves Sophie in the best possible way, and he hears about her pain. And a question that I ask over and over again as I read this book again and again, I ask myself, who suffers more? And this is what literature, I think, is supposed to do. Who suffers more? The immediate sufferer or the sufferer or the victim? Or someone who loves the sufferer? And who suffers more than in this book? Sophie herself, and she suffers immeasurably. But so does Stingle, because he's learned to love her. And that love develops over 629 pages. And Sophie has all kinds of things that she encounters. But as she encounters these things and tells Stingle about them, Stingle becomes more and more aware of what Sophie has been through and how Auschwitz could even be developed. And at one point, stepping aside from his relationship with Sophie, he just talks to the reader. And he says, it is a liberal fallacy, he's got liberal in quotes, it is a liberal fallacy that equates the military mind with real evil and makes it the exclusive province of, it is evil, makes it the exclusive province of lieutenants or generals. The secondary evil of which the military is frequently capable is aggressive, romantic, melodramatic, thrilling, orgasmic. That's what Clint Eastwood and John Wayne are all about, right? I mean, this is war, and this is fun, and his, not fun, but it's, here are the words, aggressive, romantic, melodramatic, thrilling, orgasmic. Real evil, Stingle now is learning. The suffocating evil of Auschwitz. Gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring, and it was perpetrated almost exclusively by civilians. This is the writer who says, we have to penetrate Auschwitz. We have to begin to look at it so we can understand, at least get a glimpse of, how does evil work and how does it get started? And where do we put our foot down? Back to the analogy of the speeding trap, or the speeding, cheating, child abuse next door, spousal abuse next door. Where do we put it down? When do we speak up? Sophie goes on with all kinds of experiences in this wonderful novel, and I'll end my talk so we can have some response, a little time for that anyway. Stingle himself seems to have to make a choice between deciding if the world is good or if the world is evil. And it's pretty clear that the world is full of evil. Sophie makes a choice that evil must rule the world. And it's no wonder that she makes that choice, because she's had to make a choice herself. And I want to read that choice to you. Well, I can't read it to you. I didn't Xerox it. I had to underline this stuff. So I Xeroxed the book in the library so I could underline it. But here's how it goes. So I think I can remember it. Sophie, at one time in her life, had two children. Stingle doesn't learn this until late in his relationship with her. And she's arrested for stealing a ham to bring to her mother, who has tuberculosis. And she's arrested and taken to Auschwitz with her two children. And she walks up on the ramp, and Dr. von Niemand, that's the fictitious name that Styron gives to this guy who's there at the ramp, makes her realize immediately upon her arrival that she's involved in a selection. And he says to her, I'd like to get you in bed with me. That's the first thing he says to her. And she says, Mein Hauptmann, I am a devout Catholic. I am not Jewish. And my children are not Jewish. Can you let me go? And he says, you are not Jewish. You are a devout Catholic. You are a Christian. Did not your God say, suffer the little children that they should come unto me? And she says, yes, mein Hauptmann. You may choose one. Bitte? That's her response. Again, she says, bitte? You may choose one. You're not a Jew, you're a Yid. You have a choice. But I can't choose, she says. Both of them. As you maybe know, Auschwitz is the work camp, Birkenau is the death. I mean, they're just across the railroad tracks from each other. Both of them are sent to Birkenau. So as they're hauled off, she says, "Eva, my little one." And Eva goes on, and Jan, the boy, comes back. And Jan and she go to Auschwitz, and Eva is hauled off to the Birkenau. That's her choice. That's what she lives with. That's an unthinkable kind of choice. I saw heads go down like, I mean, it must be apparent. How, it's impossible. It's unthinkable and it's impossible. Yet she had to do it. And of course, it's not a choice. It's a response. It's guts. She did anything she could to even have one alive. Stingo knows all this. And Stingo loses Sophie at the end. And he's alone deciding that Sophie has chosen to look at the world that all that's there is evil. And I think readers and people who confront the Holocaust say the same thing. The world is evil, and I won't have it so. Stingo decides that the world is both evil and good, and he says at the end of the book, it's not Judgment Day, and that there are great powers of evil and there are great powers of good, and we can tap the right ones. He doesn't say it that way. But it's the beginning of his, do you get the sense of this? Of his rise to this kind of now what is really virtue. Now he isn't looking for the first girl he can find to have sex with. Now he's not worried about where he's going to pay the rent. Now he's got an understanding of what evil is and how he can tap good. And this is how he says that at the end of the book. He's out on the beach and he's all alone. And he goes to his diary. He says, I wrote three sentences to myself those years ago. And the first one, someday I will understand Auschwitz. This was a brave statement, but innocently absurd. No one will ever understand Auschwitz. What I might have set down with more accuracy would have been this. Someday I will write about Sophie's life and death, and thereby help demonstrate how absolute evil is never extinguished from the world. Auschwitz itself remains inexplicable. The most profound statement yet made about Auschwitz was not a statement at all, but a response. The query. At Auschwitz, tell me, where was God? And the answer, where was man? It's a rise to virtue. And it's a rise to a sense of what causes evil. And is it some outside force that's banging on our doors? The second line I have resurrected from my from the void, he says, from his notes. The second line I have resurrected from the void may be a little too facile, but I have kept it. Let your love flow out on all living things. These words, at a certain level, have the quality of a strapping homily. Nonetheless, they are remarkably beautiful, strung together in their honest, lump-like English syllables. And as I see them now on the ledger's page, the page itself, the hue of a dried daffodil and oxidized slowly by time into near transparency, my eyes are arrested by the furious underlining, scratch, 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 lacerations even, as if that old Stingo whom I once inhabited, the movement, whom I once inhabited, or who once inhabited me, learning at first hand and for the first time in his grown-up life about death and pain and loss. I started this whole thing out with saying, it happened to my sister. It happened to my brother. And Stingo says at the end, I've learned about death and pain and loss, and the appalling enigma of human existence was trying physically to excavate from the paper the only remaining, perhaps the only bearable truth in life. Let your love flow out on all living things. For did not, says Stingo, Auschwitz effectively block the flow of that titanic love like some fatal embolism in the bloodstream of mankind. It's a wonderful metaphor, isn't it? Auschwitz is the embolism in the bloodstream of mankind. For did not Auschwitz effectively block the flow of thy titanic love like some fatal embolism in the bloodstream of mankind, or alter the nature of love entirely so as to reduce to absurdity the idea of loving an ant or a salamander or a viper or a toad or a tarantula or a rabies virus, or even blessed and beautiful things in a world which permitted the black edifice of Auschwitz to be built? I do not know. Perhaps it is too early to tell. At any rate, I have preserved those words, again, let your love flow out on all living things, as a reminder of some fragile yet perdurable hope. I'm not Jewish, I'm not a survivor, neither are we. but it maybe is an okay thing to hop into some literature and take that journey ourselves, out of our own innocence, into the experience of walking in someone else's shoes, whether it's by video or by poetry or by this novel or by Night itself or by countless books out there, stories about the Holocaust, stories that tell the truth, that don't put it in historical context. They do, but more importantly, they put it in human context, in emotional, psychological, and theological context. And that journey is one that those survivors have taken, and that we can take that same journey, not through the concentration camps, but from innocence to experience to a kind of higher awareness that enables us to create virtue. And I think that literature, that's its greatest gift for us.